get shit done. That's my number one imperative. Anyone who doesn't do it, it's written everywhere in the office. Anyone who doesn't look like they're doing that is getting on my nerves real quick.
We rightly celebrate the struggles of startups and their brave founders, but it can be tough working in a bigger company too, where powerful corporate antibodies seek and destroy new ideas that don't conform to the conventional culture. But some leaders battle the status quo inside their own companies to innovate and drive change. These are the serial entrepreneurs, and this is their story.
So I'm Duana Blomstrom, and I am Chief Growth Officer for Marketplace in Temenos.
Tell us about Temenos and your job.
Well, Temenos is one of the original fintech companies. Despite its huge size these days, they've done really, really well in the market. And my particular to-do is, along with some visionaries within Temenos who have some amazing hero stories, and they are the real entrepreneurs, is to kind of help them build the biggest platform that banking ever needed.
So what was your childhood like? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Bucharest.
Romania.
Bucharest, Romania, yes. Well, in between, really, because my father was American and my mother was Romanian, so I traveled to the States quite a while. I went to France a number of times. But mostly, yes, in Bucharest, Romania, so in a very communist environment.
And you studied at university in Romania?
I started over there, and then I moved to the States, and I went to school in New York, and then I came back to Romania at the end of school. I have a degree in psychology, and then reformed and went back to school to do some business as well.
So when you studied, you started in international business, so were you always destined for a career in business?
At first, I thought I was going to be a psychologist, of course, for a while.
Because you ended up with a master's in psychology from NYU.
For a while there, I thought that I was going to do that. It seemed like so much fun. I still think it's so much fun, but I don't think so much. It's almost like a career in music. So much fun might not be what you should be doing so that you make a buck. So the business bit seemed to be fascinating from a psychologist's perspective. So I couldn't really relate with organizational psychology, or else I would have entered that field. I think that's very stuck. I was just talking to a very close friend who has a doctorate in psychology, and she was of the same opinion that what we learn in organizational psychology in schools is from 60, 70 years ago research. It doesn't apply at all to corporate entities. But that was a sweet spot all along, looking back. I just couldn't have put my finger on it. So I started in international business, doing business development, sales, marketing, and just strategy in general.
So then you went on to get your MBA at Georgetown.
Yes.
So business has always been a pull, but something pulling you to psychology too. So you must like the human side of business.
Right, the human side of business, just kind of understanding what makes big bodies of people work together is absolutely fascinating. I find myself in the day job having to pull myself from daydreaming around what is it that made the name of a product what it is within Temenos, and kind of working it out in my head that it must have been this board meeting that happened just after that type of a conference, and those people would have been tired, and it would have just been a change of arms, and then I have to pull myself back and go, that's completely irrelevant to what we're doing today. You need to stop daydreaming about organizations and culture.
So you just can't stop yourself from analyzing, can you?
Yes, I probably cannot. That's sad.
What was your first job out of university?
I was very lucky. I got a really, really high position right away. I'm not quite sure why. I had a 3-month stint with a really big consultancy. I'm not even going to name, because I'm not very proud of that. Huge one. It was just painful, after which I got a job as almost the director of sales of a young software company. I didn't know anything about it, of course. So I had to learn. They were doing CRM. They were selling something in that area. And so I learned quite fast with that. But I also left and started my company within a couple of years of that, maybe 3 years of that, I'm not sure.
So you come out of college, you're an entrepreneur, rising quickly through different companies, and then you decide it's time to start your own
consultancy
thing.
A consultancy that did quite well, and it grew really fast. And it was, I think, my first brush with the fact that you can become, from a startup, the buds of becoming a corporation seem to insert themselves early in the culture of a company. We grew to when I sold it, I think we were about 32 internal and a bunch of other people external. But I think over the 15-20 people mark, the organization starts becoming very different, very fast. And as a if you're heading it and you're its CEO, you probably don't quite see it that way, and you're just so focused on numbers and growth. And I mean, you know, we keep telling them you should hire for culture, you should keep an eye on that. But people have much more immediate P&L needs, and they do forget about it. So, and in particular, young entrepreneurs, the last thing they think is that they're going to abandon the fire in their belly and get the wrong people in. But I think that's a serious risk with anyone growing above a certain size.
Well, the pattern is always when you're young as a company or as a person, you've got nothing to lose. You might take big risks. And as soon as you have something to lose, you start to protect it, and you start to you know, kind of try to build a moat around your business, and that will work for a while, but it doesn't work forever.
No. And it's also, it depends on the definition of a risk. I think that not looking at your culture, and I've seen this in at least three companies in my life when they went above a certain size and they lost sight of what really matters. I think that's a bigger risk. I think that's a serious risk. It's one thing that we talk about, how do we fix culture in big organizations such as banks and so on. It's a very important lesson that we very rarely talk about in the industry, no less because it's not needed. There are not a lot of startups that got to that stage, but the ones that did can very quickly become a corporation if they start losing what I call their core and their religion.
How old were you when you first started your own company?
God, I feel so old not remembering those times, but I must have been 25, not very young.
That took a lot of guts.
No, it felt like absolutely easy and normal. I was so lucky I came in the market at the right time. I mean, to sell your company a year later of a sizable, I thought I'm going to be winning like this and buying Apple anytime now. I, you know, life has taught me over time that was very, very silly. I've actually attempted to do the exact same thing years later in Sweden, and it failed horribly. It absolutely did none of the things that I thought it was going to be doing. It had great ideas. I knew kind of how to run a company. It still didn't happen. There's so many reasons why that might not work that I feel like I was naive to think that it would do when it did.
So. Well, Bill Gates has said, success is a poor teacher.
Exactly. That's a very good one. Yes.
You know, we have some success and that we tend to kind of round off all the little mistakes we made along the way and just assume that, well, we're probably good at anything.
In particular, in looking back, everything seems much rosier and holier, and like you don't need to think of, sit around and think of the wrong turns, in particular if you did well. But right after that, I had a very rude awakening on the job market. Because after having sold my company, I moved countries, I moved to Sweden. And I started two or three things. In short, in about 2 years, I finished the entire money I had made on my consultancy just by trying various things, anything from restaurants to a nail salon to just investing in silly things. So I ended up having to take a job, any job. And being English speaking in a country that only really employs people who speak Swedish has been challenging, to put it mildly. So I started from minus one, I wouldn't even call it zero. I sold conferences for a company called, like, I don't even want to plug them, a horrible company. And it was a sweatshop. There's no other way to explain it. It was a very humbling experience. I made a lot of money doing that. I'm not quite sure why. But it killed my soul within the 6 months while I was still like looking for a real job and interviewing with headhunters by day for glamorous VP positions and working in that job by night. It's been a very interesting time, to put it mildly. And then eventually one of these many interviews worked out. I got a VP of business development position with a software company selling IP address management, something really glamorous at the time. And so life was back on track. But there have been some up and downs in a short period of time that taught me very interesting lessons.
So you've had a lot of different jobs, a lot of experience, but a common thread in your career has been sales and business development and marketing. Do you think that's a critical skill for anybody who wants to be an entrepreneur?
Yes, and it's a horrible thing to have to do. I don't like sales. Everybody hates sales. There's nobody who says they like sales.
But clearly you've been good at it.
That's a curse. It's not necessarily a blessing. I've very many times tried to get away from it. I don't like sales at all. I don't think I'm selling at all. I think I'm relatable. In perspective, people kind of like me. And I think that what I've sold on all along has been the fact that people can feel when you know stuff. So people that need to buy from you, in particular in software, in particular in an area like ours, which is, you know, whether it was a telco business or more importantly in the banking business, people buy knowledge. They buy the fact that you know what you're on about. And as soon as I learn something and I can relate to it and I explain it with enough passion, that's supposedly a sale, but I wouldn't call it sales. Evidently the monetary exchange has to happen, and I don't like it, but of course I like the money of it. Who doesn't? Let's stop pretending we're doing this for the greater good. We're all trying to make a buck. So yes, sales is sadly a staple of it. And, you know, to a degree, the job I'm doing today is meant to be sales to a large extent, but the name of it being growth is, I think, a lot more appropriate, because at a certain point, it's not about the sales, it's about whether or not you're growing at the right, and money is going to come at the right time as well, hopefully.
So you have kind of a separation of that. There is a need, as you say, we all have it, to make money and to make a living. But that doesn't always necessarily connect with what drives your passion. So maybe that's why you've always had kind of a side hustle going on, or you've alternated between corporate jobs and entrepreneurial jobs and so on. Do you think that's the driver of that?
I think so. I think I can't do anything I don't fall in love with. Exactly because of this, because I know I wouldn't be good at it. So if you made me sell something I didn't believe in, I would be horrible at it. I would not be able to put the words together. So the driver there is just finding things that I know really well and I get really passionate about. And in all honesty, and it's probably not very common, but I love this bit. I love the technology bit. I sadly understand a lot more than some developers do. It's not sales. It's just like learning something really well and then talking about it, and then people kind of see sense and want to give you money for it.
Were you always entrepreneurial as a kid? Were you the kind of kid with a lemonade stand at the end of your driveway, that sort of thing?
Well, I would make my parents pay for shows, but not the lemonade stand. That wasn't.
So you put on shows.
Like, that wasn't. Then they had to pay for a ticket, yes, to get in.
But, you sold tickets to your family.
To my own show. Yes.
What did you perform in your shows?
Poetry and dancing, I believe. I haven't actually thought about those 50 years ago in ages now. But just a normal kids show, and then they got tickets to it. But it wasn't looked upon as a good quality to have, evidently. I mean, living in a communist society, no one expected to have a lemonade stand. You shouldn't be talking about exchanging value in any other way.
You can tell that question came from a Midwestern American upbringing, right? Where that would have been very normal, but you grew up in a pretty oppressive communist dictatorship for most of your childhood.
Right.
And you're right. So that those kinds of things wouldn't have been encouraged from society as a whole around you. What about your parents? Where did this drive come from?
I think it was, I'm not sure I have it from them. I mean, they owned a couple of businesses over the years, but my mother was an artist and my father was an engineer, so absolutely out of business, really, and not very entrepreneurial themselves. But with that said, over the years, they seem to have, to me, it was very clear that I can't even live in a place that's not encouraging to that type of endeavor. For instance, I really didn't like living in Sweden, because for all its modern amenities, Sweden isn't, and for all you hear in the papers, to my mind, it was just not the type of culture that is encouraging you to work harder and know more and try. And if you don't do those things and you don't go hard doing those things, then it's just not fun to be living anywhere. So Sweden was very much reminded me a lot of communist Romania, and that's why I decided to move to London. London feels like people are built to try hard, to learn a lot, to hustle, yes. So
it's a global city of commerce.
Yes, feels that way.
So who inspired you growing up? Were there either mentors or bosses that you had, or maybe even a public figure that you read about or heard about?
Horrible with that question, I have to say, because it sounds so so self-important, but I'm not very good with role models. I tend to really, really like people and collect brains. I have a brain fetish with people, but I don't know that either of them gets to the quite mentor status. I probably don't invest enough time in a relationship even with someone that did, or I've not had that opportunity. In terms of bosses, it's really difficult. I think I was thinking about this the other day. I've not really had a lot of bosses, which is not a plus, in particular because I find it typically like the only people would be the board or the CEO. So, and in the cases I've been in, building something with them, it has never been that they were my boss, we were partners in building something. And sometimes I've really longed for having a boss. That would be cool, I think, just having someone that I can look up to and I feel like the P&L still sits with them. That would be marvelous. And I'm, to a degree, I mean, we're all running this thing together and building it together. But to a degree, I'm trying to make my current co-manager get in that role just for fun, just to try it out. But it would be so inspiring. I can only imagine how great it must be to be around someone that you like and you believe in. So,
well, how do you try to inspire other people, the people that work around you or for you?
This is exactly why it's difficult not to have had a boss and not to have had a model of how that is. I mean, you can read all the books, but until you really live it, it's difficult. I'm a very clear type of horrible boss. And I am probably not nice. I'm absolutely not politically correct. And I'm very no-nonsense. But I'm a big believer in the whole carrot and stick thing and extreme honesty, which is if someone makes a mistake, how radio politically correct was that? I was going to use another terminology. Then
I'm not going to call it an opportunity.
Yes. I'll be very vocal about it and very clear. I won't call people names. I won't scream at them. I mean, we're all civilized adults, but I will absolutely not sugarcoat it. We don't have time for this. We're accomplishing too big of things to sit around and be silly. With that said, I'll also be full of praise every 5 seconds if it's necessary. So I'm not sure that that's absolutely the best type of boss to be. I'm very Marmite, like boss-wise. I know people, many people in big organizations who absolutely adore their bosses. And if you go up the ranks and look at what those bosses have done, it's the less contact and the less pressure and the less control and the less, almost the opposite of what I do. With that said, and I understand that that's how they function in my relationships with my guys, while I try and show them that I'm in love with what I do and I want them to be in the same thing, and while I insist that they learn continuously, because otherwise we're all going to fall, I'm also very no-nonsense and probably not everyone's cup of tea.
What's the biggest mistake you ever made, and what did you learn from it?
Biggest mistake I've ever made was run too far ahead, and I've done that one time famously, and then I'm catching myself now when that happens many times. I'm very quick. I've learned in time that I'm quicker than other people, not in a very smart way, just faster at some things, meaning
faster at catching on or faster at acting or
at
both?
At both, I think. And I, like, in terms of, for instance, I'll meet someone and I'll have a very clear idea of what they're like. If I tell other people what they're like after a meeting, they'll think I'm absolutely out of it. They take time to arrive to that, which is normal type of time to invest in that. The same thing for ideas, same things for doing things. So from that perspective, if I arrive to something very quickly, I expect people to be in the same rhythm, and then I just kind of go to the next step and the next step, and I have to at least, at the very least, remember what the big picture is, stop and keep everyone in the same team. Because sometimes it doesn't matter. So it took me a while to understand team sports, to be fair, because you can run too fast for your team to a degree that it will be completely worthless to the entire business. So what I'm learning is that we have to, it's not good enough that I overachieve. We have to all overachieve at the same time.
So there's a natural kind of independent contributor aspect to what you have done your whole life, and part of being a part of a team and especially a leader of a team is to bring others along.
Yeah, it's a bit of a struggle. I think about this a lot these days because I think it's incredibly important that we teach our kids that having a personal brand is just, it's incredibly important today in today's world, and just keeping true to what you really believe in and having a voice is crucial. Otherwise, the whole conversation would break. So that's important. At the same time, you can't be too involved in your own personal brand. You can't forget about it and be nothing but a team player, because that's a mistake. But you can't be so involved that you're not bringing others along on the same path and you stop inspiring anybody. So it's a thing I think about a lot these days, along with the fact that transferring knowledge to people seems to be an impossibly complicated task in our industry. Not impossible, it's just a challenge that needs sorting. It's not, you can teach someone physics or math, we're clear what those things are. We're not clear what we're building in this industry. And transferring something that's very personal and it's grown from years of seeing things with your own eyes is almost like trying to translate folklore into sheets and tomes of learnings, and it's not easy, but it's also something that's part of, I think, inspiring if you do it right. Otherwise, it can just be so overwhelming that people don't even want to touch our industry anymore. So those are things that I think about a lot these days in my own role.
So the difference between mastering the known knowns and exploring the unknown.
Right, exactly. And I find myself, I think I'm in a very funny situation in terms of culture, because I spent the last 2.5 years teaching big banks how to change their own culture. So I now find myself in a semi-corporate environment. It's not a real corporate environment. It's actually truly on the inside, a very entrepreneurial and startup-y type of place. We are still 4,000 people, which makes it a huge organization. So you have some of the challenges of a bank. Yes. So it makes them almost the same challenges that a bank would have. Well, not to the same degree, because we're agile and we're smart and we're with it. But it's still the type of place where you have to think about culture in the same way as the people I was preaching to had to a couple of months ago.
When you're preaching, as you say, helping people in larger companies make change, what's maybe the number one piece of advice you give them on how to change their culture?
I have two exact methods for this particular type of transformation that I've detailed in my emotional banking book. But in all honesty, the culture, I think these two methods would work in any type of organization, although it's a whole other conversation. I know I'm digressing. I'll come back to your question. But I think it's an interesting question. Are banks a normal type of organization, or because of this imperative between customer experience and technology and numbers and this really difficult conflict of interest, are they not a very different type of organization? So I think that's something to be, I don't know the answer, but I think it's something to be explored. But I put together these two methods that I think are easily transformationable. It's not even a word, but they would be bringing in the most change at the fastest pace. And those are, one of them is called the Keep It Real program, which is teaching banks or any organization really to start speaking English again.
To keep it real,
to ditch the consultancy speak. Even to swear for half a day. We're having a swear fest we're doing as a workshop.
You're teaching corporate employees how to swear?
To swear, yes. No, not teaching them, giving them license to just kind of be themselves for 5 minutes. And I think you'd find it amazing. I've done only two of those. I wish I could do more. One with an English bank and one with a bank somewhere else in Europe. But they were really fun, because for 2 or 3 hours absolutely nobody opens their mouth and they just glare at you and wonder why they're paying you all this money. So
who
that
is
you
this
make
weird
them,
lady?
Yeah, make them do that and nothing happens. But once they do start doing it and they go through the exercise, the floodgates of communication just seem to open up, and they don't continue swearing. They start talking about things they haven't talked to each other for ages, and they're all work-related, and you should see them still talking about those at the pub afterwards. So clearly, it just gives them license to start communicating. So that's one of them. The other one, because I think changing language and letting people be courageous enough is key. And then the second part is the Build a Voice program that I've done with a couple of banks. And that one just builds people with heart and knowledge that become interested in our industry. It can be any industry, but in our case, it's easy because fintech is addictive. But in other industries, I'm sure they would find something to be interested in. But once they start getting enough knowledge and reading you and reading the Titans and looking up to this world where there is real-life dialogue, they become entrenched in it, they fall in love with it, and that trickles down in the organization in a way that you can't mandate any other fashion. So
that's great. Do you have any favorite business books?
new, I have to admit. Half of them, I find them really painful to read. In fact, if I had to name one that I think everyone should read, it's called, I think it's called Operation Phoenix. And it's like a chick lit book for DevOps.
Chick lit for DevOps.
That's what I would describe it.
I have no idea what to make out of that.
Totally read it. It is just stunning. I asked every CIO I ever met to read them, and they then bought the famously the ex-CIO of Lloyd bought a few of those and gave them to his team. Amazing, amazing book.
Do you have a favorite saying or words of wisdom you like to live by, or maybe framed on your wall?
Yes, but most of them are not radio friendly. The ones that I suppose I really need everyone to keep thinking of is that as long as we have brains, courage, and passion, we can get literally anything done. But it has to be all three, and it has to be in spades.
Just for fun, what's one of the non-radio friendly ones?
Are you going to cut it out later?
I don't know. It's a podcast.
It's get shit done. That's my number one imperative. Anyone who doesn't do it, it's written everywhere in the office. Anyone who doesn't look like they're doing that is getting on my nerves real quick.
Is that a part of the Keep It Real program?
It's part of the Keep It Real program, yes.
Great. This was awesome. I'm JP Nichols. This has been the Serial Entrepreneur podcast. If you like the show, please give it a 5-star rating. That really helps other people discover it. You can also learn more and support this and all the other great podcasts from Provoke Media at provoke.fm.